Blog Talk Radio.
Now, I don't know when he would, when we he knew this, but I was quite convinced, very convinced, by, I don't want to say when, that the CIA or some agency decided to use LSD to chemically, psychologically bomb the baby boomers, and to just knock them out of action, and that there's a lot of suspicion that, for example, that Timothy Leary was a government agent.
I give the CIA a total credit for sponsoring and initiating the entire consciousness movement, counterculture events of the 1960s.
In my opinion, is the general availability of LSD was there's a lot of reason to believe that it was a government program that got out of control. See, when you take LSD, they didn't occur to them that you become a free agent. And so they thought of it in one way because they're the military, right? Or control, and those who took it no longer were under control, or lots of them. And so the whole thing got completely crazy and out of hand. And whether or not Pynchon would have been aware of this is one thing. How about if he was part of it? You said. And how about if Gravity's Rainbow represents the urge to confess? You know? And I'm not saying that this is the case, but those are the kind of speculations that it leads to. You say, I don't remember too much about that in the book, but I mean, there are hints that he was aware of it. And how he became aware of it? The same way I became aware of it. You just put things together, you know?
Welcome to In Our Craft or Sullen Art. I'm your host, Richard Weissman. And this is Late Night Poets. They tell me it's the largest poetry group on allpoetry.com, which is the largest social media poetry website on the internet. And that was a friend of Thomas Pynchon talking about whether Pynchon was in fact a government agent, a CIA agent, an interesting concept. So my co-host, Neutron Bomb, is on leave, but she will be back probably in July. We've been talking. That's what she came up with as her re-entry point. I'm still waiting for my substitute co-host to join us live on the air, but I believe I've got Laurent on. Let me bring him on. Is that Laurent?
It is indeed. How are you doing, Richard?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Not too bad. Glad to be of some company to you. I realize you're flying solo today.
Yeah, so Babbler is my substitute co-host. I'm still waiting for her to show, but I know she's on the West Coast, so it can be a little dicey. But I am very glad that you were able to join me on the air. And that intro, obviously, so I don't know if you know this, but Thomas Pynchon is famous for never being photographed. There is no interviews with him, so that ain't happening. But his friend was the intro. So, and I do believe this might be Babbler. Let me bring the person on the air, and we'll find out.
Hey, 715,
you're on the air.
Yeah, sorry to disappoint you.
You are never a disappointment, Pam.
Good.
How could you ever be a disappointment? So, and thanks for joining us on the air.
Absolutely.
Have you been?
Absolutely, happy to. Doing good. Yep. I hope, and you too. And I'm guessing we have Lauren with us.
We do. Yep.
Wonderful. So, well, hello, Lauren.
So, yeah, so I was just kind of introducing that relatively short intro, which is Thomas Pynchon's friend discussing whether Pynchon was a CIA agent and whether there were coded messages in Gravity's Rainbow, whether it was kind of a confession of his complicity in the novel. So I don't know. I just thought it was kind of an interesting thing. We're never going to get an interview with Pynchon. It's just not who he is. Lots of writers are very private people. So God bless us for doing radio shows.
Right. I get that. And
yeah.
And you know, and even the radio shows, there's just, you know, kind of a slight separation, I think, of things that you would reveal to closest friends and things that you would say on a radio show, you know?
Yeah.
But now I don't know a lot about this author, Pynchon.
he is famously difficult. His novels are incredibly long and some would argue inaccessible, but there's no question this guy is a genius. He's very, very bright. Not only is he a brilliant author, but I believe he has a PhD in math as well. So he's no slouch.
Oh, wow.
And I find his work fascinating. He's got multiple plot lines running. It's really hard to get a short clip that explains his work because the work is so dense and complex. But he's great. So here's the question. Laurent, I don't know how familiar you are with Pynchon, but do you think he could have been a CIA agent like his friend was saying?
Well, first, a quick question. He's always referred to as his friend, in quotes. Who is his friend?
You know, honestly, before this YouTube interview, I had never heard of the gentleman in question. Old friend Jules Siegel interview. I don't know.
Okay. All right. I had no idea. I tell you, anything is possible in this day and age. It would stretch my credulity, though, a little bit to think that he was an agent. I mean, if he's that dedicated to his privacy and everything else, I can't see him all of a sudden breaking character and becoming an undercover spy or something all of a sudden.
Yeah.
The only thing it's funny, I read Gravity's Rainbow, and I remember way back when I was a kid, almost a kid, and I remember nothing about it except that I loved the book. I'm certain of that, but I couldn't tell you a word from that book.
Yeah, and it's an incredibly complicated plot. It's my favorite Pynchon novel. It's basically, there's multiple plot lines running, almost kind of stream of consciousness. I think the main plot is Slothrop is an agent in wartime London, and the screaming across the sky is the V2 rockets, which, becomes our German scientists after the war. Werner von Braun is actually plays a part in the novel as well. So it's that whole plot line of, you know, technology gone awry and destroying the city of London. And that is the screaming across the sky that starts the novel. It's a historical novel and simultaneously dystopian. So it's amazing. I think with that, it's probably a decent segue. So Pam, How do you feel about playing sub co-host for us?
I will be happy to do that.
Thanks so much. Yeah, and if Babbler shows, then great.
If Babbler shows, I will also be glad to pass off the torch and let her finish the end of the race or whatever part of the race she finishes.
Yep.
All right. Did you have a specific poem that you wanted to start with, or do you want me?
So here's my feeling. We do maybe start with Do No Harm and then do the carryovers.
All right. All right. Sounds like a good plan. I will go ahead and go grab that one and do. There we go. All right. All right, so we have Do No Harm by Arliss D. And Richard, go ahead and give that one a read for us, please.
Okay, thanks so much. So this is Arliss D, Do No Harm. Rainwater pools at the low point of the yard, overshadowed by a towering pin oak, tallest tree in town, or so say the arborists. Their intent is only to climb, not cut. First, do no harm. In the Half Moon Theater at Epidaurus, I stand on stage and recite the opening lines of Oedipus Rex, my voice reverberating with perfect pitch, reaching the farthest seats, like an oracle proclaiming my fate. Scramble up the oak, settle in the crook of a branch, reach for a perch as high as Agamemnon's throne. I hear sheep clang in the vale. They soothe me as I survey my ruined kingdom. At first, I do no harm in my dreams. Grief. I reshape them to fit my earthly needs. They tumble down hillsides into earth's wild quarries. I chisel my block of stone, smooth its edges. In the distance, my father approaches. Oh, Oedipus, above all, do no harm. End of poem. And Laurent, I'm giving you first word.
Fascinating piece, but you do no harm. The first stanza that addresses the tallest tree in town, with their intent is only to climb, not cut, first do no harm. And then the segue to the Half Moon Theater at Epidaurus gives us two entirely different storylines until we get to the third stanza, in which he almost becomes one of the arborists himself. Scrambling up the oak to settle in the crook of a branch. I like the line, reach for a perch as high as Agamemnon's throne. Agamemnon, as the AN says, was one of the main characters in Homer's Iliad, something I do remember reading and enjoying. I read that at least a couple of times, and I always liked Agamemnon's name. It had a certain majesty about it. And then he evidently is dreaming of standing on the stage. It's a dream in which he reshapes Greece, only to find out his father is part of, I guess, his dream. O Oedipus, above all, do no harm, which is incredibly ironic because Oedipus does end up killing his father. It's a very strange look at a couple of things. The Oedipus storyline, his dream, how we would reshape Greece. And I almost wonder if he plays the part of Agamemnon in his mind But he says, I hear the sheep bells clanging in the veil. They soothe me as I survey my ruined kingdom. But that's puzzling because, well, I don't know if I'm anywhere close to being real on this particular poem. Very nice version of Oedipus, I think.
Absolutely. Great analysis of the piece. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, that really was a great analysis. Very cool. I thought this had amazing imagery and metaphors. I don't really know much about the story of Oedipus Rex, but, you know, I like the imagery and metaphors in this. I like the way it flows, and I think it speaks well on the whole idea of the production of life and how we're formed from other people's advice. I think that especially comes through in that last stanza. At first I do no harm in my dreams of Greece. I reshape them to fit my earthly needs. They tumble down hillside into earth's wild quarries. I chisel my block of stone, smooth its edges. I also think that there's that idea of a shaping from, you know, unforeseen events that are tragic in the making. So, you know, wonderful lines and very well done.
Excellent comment there, Pam. Yeah, I love this piece. So, and always a challenge to go after you guys because you give such great analysis of the piece. And yes, I agree, Laurent, full of irony all over the place. Do no harm. And of course, Oedipus is going to kill his father. So lots of harm being done. An incredibly layered and compelling and complex poem, which is a nice way to attack A Knight of Pynchon, because Pynchon is nothing if he's not complex. Lots of hidden meaning for scholars and lovers of the arts alike. I especially like my voice reverberating with perfect pitch reaching the farthest seats, like an oracle proclaiming my fate. As it speaks to the cloaked double entendre, since the actor's voice reverberating to the farthest seats is known in the theater as playing to the gods, and the gods obviously loom large in both ancient Greece in general and Greek theater in particular. What a brilliant poem this was, and my gosh, when I read it, I was incredibly impressed the first time, reading it on the air, even more impressed. So just an amazing response to the prompt, and just so we're all on the same page, that prompt was idle dreaming is often the essence of what we do. Just a wonderful way to start the evening. Okay, Pam, I believe we're back to you.
Okay, well, I did have a quick question. Was Oedipus, yeah, was he the one that had like an affair with either his mother or his stepmother, or was that somebody else?
Yep, so Oedipus the king, Rex means king, kills his father and has sex with his mom. So it's the whole Freudian thing, you know. Freud picked up on this, and of course, if you're not familiar with Oedipus Rex, we get it again, because that's something that Shakespeare was famous for, was taking these old tropes and putting new life on them in his unique voice, and that becomes Hamlet in Shakespeare's capable hand.
Ah. Okay. Right. Okay. So, that's right. So I had heard of the phrase, you know, the Oedipus complex, and I knew there was,
yes,
a classic novel where that was a famous part of it. So, okay,
mm-hmm,
cool.
Yeah.
Learn something
new. Yeah, it all
new.
Starts with the Greek. Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah, I've been teaching all day in the commodities world. We're teaching here tonight too.
Oh, funny. All right. Well, up next we have Perception in Unknown Territory, A Precipice by Jenny the Deep. And we have a recording for that whenever you're ready, Richard.
Okay.
Perception in Unknown Territory, A Precipice. Staring off into the dark abyss of the unknown. Walking on life's precipice, trying to gain recourse. Recounting, reflecting, finding new perceptions. Trying not to fall from the edge, I clear my head. Life is a constant uphill battle. You never know what it will bring. Open its door anyway, for it may lead to a miraculous surprise of a new point of view. Fear and anger are causes of self-destruction. Don't let the different and a no deter you. To know everything is boring. Never be afraid to open your mind's eye to new possibilities. End poem.
Thank you for the SoundCloud, Jenny. All right. Cam, why don't you start us off?
This is a nicely written philosophical write. I like how she speaks on the uphill battle of life. And, you know, there's two things that really help you with that battle, and that reaching the top of that proverbial mountain is, first of all, you know, having a determination, setting aside fear and anger, and also having a new mind's eye, a new mindset. You know, it really was a wonderful write on that uphill climb to conquer the challenges of life with a changed mindset. And I liked it all the way through, but it was that second stanza that really spoke to me. Life is a constant uphill battle. You never know what it will bring. Open its door anyway, for it may lead to a miraculous surprise of a new point of view. You know, and that is so true of life. You have to move forward and understand that it is unpredictable. So very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah. And so we're all on the same page. This was inspired by the Huxley. This was one of our carryovers, inspired by the Huxley quote about the doors of perception. There are things known and there are things unknown, and in between are the doors of perception. And I think Jenny's response to the prompt was, as you stated, Pam, highly philosophical and full of real wisdom. There's a humility. And it's funny because even the tone of her voice is kind of humble. And she delivers this all without being overwritten, because I think philosophical poems, and I'm probably guilty of this myself sometimes, it's very easy to overwrite them because you're trying to give this kind of treatise in verse form. She doesn't do that. She just gives us the truth, her truth. And I especially like that close. To know everything is boring. Never be afraid to open your mind's eye to new possibilities. And isn't that what life is all about, is constantly learning and being open to new possibilities? Nicely crafted. And Laurence, I'll give you final word.
Yeah, that first stanza basically addresses what is known to the poet. Excuse me. Let me rephrase. In an effort to find new perceptions, he looks deep into the unknown, while realizing that what she knows is one half or one part of life, and that all the things that are unknown, the different and the unknown, as she calls them. I'm scrambling on this for some strange reason. It's such a good little poem. She addresses the unknown as something not to fear. Fear and anger are causes of self-destruction. Don't let the different and the unknown deter you. You know, everything is boring. Never be afraid to open your mind's eye to new possibilities. Those new possibilities, it's that space where we find the doors of perception, everything between what we know and what we don't know. And fear and anger, those causes of self-destruction, will absolutely stop you from progressing in life at all. That middle stanza, life is a constant uphill battle. You never know what it will bring, is exactly what contains most of that fear and the anger, because you're always battling against something you either don't know or don't want to know or are scared of knowing. There's a whole lot going on in this little poem, which I like.
Nicely stated. Very nice. And with that, Pam, we are ready for our next one.
All right. Well, up next we have The Flaws of Perception by Jason John Morgan. And Lawrence, would you give that a read for us, please?
With pleasure. The Flaws of Perception. The philosophies of Aldous Huxley were always in a state of flux. He is the goat because he wrote without giving any dams or fucks. His lyrical hocus pocus was written with laser-like focus, though Brave New World delightfully unfurled. Point counterpoint is his magnum opus. End poem.
Nicely read there, Laurent. And the funny thing is the end of the first stanza, when I first read it, I laughed. And I laughed again. Luckily, I was on mute. Just a great poem. Very clever, lyrical, funny. I like He is the Goat. It gives it that kind of contemporary vibe. And I have never read, and I thought I had read most of Huxley's work, because I had read Island and The Doors of Perception and Brave New World, but I've never read Point Counterpoint, so I feel like I need to read it. Nicely done. Very enjoyable. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this was enjoyable. He had really great wordplay with his spelling choices. And what I particularly liked about this is he used, I feel like he used a format you wouldn't have expected. Like the fact that he wrote this in a lyric form was such a delightful and unexpected element to the poem. And it is a great thing when a show or a contest or a poem gives you the thought of, here's another book I need to put on my list. So this was quite clever. And very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Laurence's reader, I'll give you final word.
This may be the most cerebral limerick I've ever read in my life. I was absolutely delighted with the way he rhymes. The philosophies of Aldous Huxley were always in a state of flux. And then without giving any dams or fucks, it makes you laugh. But it's also absolutely brilliant. His, like Pam said, the way he went about writing this was unexpected, but absolutely delightful.
Absolutely. Great comments. Okay, and with that, Pam, we are ready for our next one.
All right. Well, up next we have Broken Hearts Galore by My Angels 3. Words escape me today. There's too much emotion to raise a whisper in play. Too many thoughts flooding my brain, filling every crevice with emotional pain. I think it's perfectly possible to die from a broken heart. I think that's what I'm going through, but mine was broken from the start. So I bleed it all out with the music and learn to forget once more that my essence is a conduit of galore and poem.
Nicely read, Pam. Yeah, this is another rhyming poem. And it was based on the Huxley quote, "After silence, that which comes nearest to expressing the inexpressible is music," which I love. And quite appropriate that the poet takes a rhyming verse to, it almost like drives home the point that musicality has this power, that after silence, it comes nearest to expressing the inexpressible. So rhymes do that for poetry as well. And the rhymes drive this poem forward in a musical manner appropriate for the given subject matter. And the poem reminds me of the Carrie Fisher quote, which is, "Take your broken heart and make it into art." Very nicely done. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Broken hearts have spawned more poems and songs, perhaps, than just about anything else. It's given birth to entire genres, for Christ's sake. The that line, "My essence is a conduit of broken hearts galore." We all have songs that touch us, that move us. Music that moves us, that reminds us of the past, and music that we absolutely dip our hearts into in an effort to rebuild them, or at least get rid of the sorrow that lies within you. I thought it was really well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Pam, your thoughts?
Oh, this is absolutely beautiful and emotive. With the rhyme, it has a wonderful lyrical quality. It's beautiful all the way through, but I especially like that third stanza, and with the idea of feeling like you could die from a broken heart. I also like the line that Laurent pointed out, which was that my essence is a conduit of broken hearts galore. It seems oftentimes when you're a person who's gone through a lot of pain and the heartbreak, you attract people that have gone through the same thing, almost as if you draw them to you. But I like that the main message of this was the idea that music is there for us and speaks to us when despair causes our own words to fail. So wonderful lines and very well done.
Excellent comment. Okay, and what do you have next for us, Pam?
All right, well, the last of our carryovers is The Voice of Music by Silvana Five, and we have a SoundCloud for that one.
Yep, fire it up.
The Voice of Music by the poetess Silvana Five. Poet of the piano, caressing the keys, weaving a kaleidoscope of colors, stirring the senses, mellifluous notes dancing on the air, exquisite and haunting, resting sublimely on the ear. Music so breathtakingly beautiful, like a soothing balm, its eloquence speaking the heart, calming the soul, taking us on a journey to a magical place where reigns peace and harmony. Your legacy lives on, Maestro. Your nonpareil gift was surely heaven sent, for angels' harps could not sound sweeter. Close your eyes and be swept away by genius.
Thank you for the SoundCloud, a wonderful collaboration. So if I'm reading the note here, this was composed by Sylvania Five, and the recitation was by her sister, which is our friend, Stelina. And nice collaboration there. Collaborations are always excellent. Really well done, and just welcome, you know. It's a beautiful thing in all the arts to be able to collaborate. And this is especially well executed, I thought. The SoundCloud really did bring it to life for me. The music, the voice, the recitation, it brought me into a peaceful space. And a skillful delivery highlighting the poem's truth. And this was another one about after silence, that which comes nearest to expressing the inexpressible is music. And I thought this poem addressed the prompt quite successfully. And Pam, your thoughts?
Oh, this is wonderful. And those two sisters make quite the dynamic duo. The combination of the write and the voice really worked well together. I love how this pays tribute to music and the magic and the power of it. I was particularly fascinated with that first stanza with the lines, poet of the piano caressing the keys, weaving a kaleidoscope of color. And I like that the notes of music do that. Like when you listen to, and I don't listen to a lot of classical music, but I do listen to some. And when I do, you can just really see like the explosion of imagery or the moves, like movement of imagery throughout your mind as you connect with the music. I also like how this speaks on the idea of how music transcends time and touches the human spirit. So beautifully written and very well done.
Absolutely, great comment. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, the Nocturne, Opus 9 by Chopin, is a wonderful reflection of the words. Music is so breathtakingly beautiful, like a soothing balm. Its eloquence is speaking to the heart, calming the soul, taking us on a journey to a magical place where reigns peace and harmony. As you listen to the notes of the piano and the rhythm and the pace at which they're being played, it just brings down my blood pressure completely and puts me in a place where I am calm. The soul is calm. The notes hit your mind just right. And it's just completely soothing. So this is a tribute to music itself and the prompt. I thought they selected some music that absolutely beautifully illustrated what the poem so well and eloquently states.
Absolutely great comment. Yeah, I think that Chopin, you know, he's living in this time where he's standing on the shoulders of genius, and you're not going to do something more kind of earth-shattering than Beethoven's Ninth. You're not going to do anything more, you know, mathematically complex than J.S. Bach. So he goes the entirely 180 from either one of them and shows us sublime, quiet,
spaces that music can evoke. And, you know, it's just really beautiful and a perfect complement to their poem. So, to her poem. So, Pam, I see you've put up our next piece.
I did, yes. Easy to Understand by Peter Solway. And Richard, go ahead, please, and give that a read for us.
Okay, so this is Peter Solway, Easy to Understand. Deaf old judge, getting all facts mixed up. Jury guilty, murderer to walk free. Mummy not married to daddy. Wig to no more fit, loose, a constant slip. Eyeglasses, snout of slippery dip. Gavel to miss, hollow bench, no knee of reflex, premonition of knighthood. Ever feeling good about myself, first wife deserved the whip, second the keen secretary, third the convent asylum, trimmed gardens, late spring, best times for visiting, old judge scratching swollen testicles, tests pending, more scans imminent, undressed the polite nurse, wig and all. Sad facts of the fate of this case. Can't judge a book by its cover or date. Lurid with picture of a bold murder. Mother stabbed in underwear. Remains in Stockholm air terminal. Pilot a pedophile. Nurse a qualified specialist. Keen on circumcised men. Jury locked up forever, debating the case. Lunch of cut sandwiches, I hear, simply sublime. Fresh eggs and ground wheat. Ham from happy pig farm. Tomatoes from neighbors. Tips on how to eat. The cars down the track. Guilty of sugar. Rotten teeth. Rotten health and teeth. Coke to feel good. Judge Judy. Glad of an alternate sex. Such founding fathers off. Here bugles blast, sir at last, compositions of a budding Bach. Perverse in the historic dark, perverts meeting, torch shining, jury called back from prison, keen as a reunion of the Ku Klux Klan, keeping friendly and warm, best verdict possible. Love unattainable, God a joke, judge incomprehensible. End of poem. And Laurent, if you could start us off.
Yeah, easy to understand in the question mark. It's all the things that are not easy to understand. The deaf old judge getting all facts mixed up, jury guilty, murderer to walk free, mummy not married to daddy. Boy, the things we discover that are our perceptions of reality, and there's quite a few of them that are listed at fourth stanza. Ever feeling good about myself, first wife deserved the whip, second the keen secretary, third the convent asylum. With very few words, he describes three different individuals, that are, not easy to understand, perhaps. This poem has a lot to offer in terms of imagery that I think we're all rather familiar with. The one that kind of, I can't figure out at all, fresh egg and ground wheat, ham from happy pig farm, made us some neighbors' tips on how to eat. Well, perhaps it's the happy pig farm is not so happy. And tomatoes from neighbors we always get. Tips on how to eat. Well, this is how you prepare them. Sage advice, perhaps, but not sure where that fits in. But at any rate, I enjoyed this a great deal.
Excellent comment. And Pam, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I have to say the moment you called on Lauren first, I was like, yes. Thank you, God. Now all I need to do is say, yes.
Yeah. I had the same thoughts in reverse.
Yeah. To me, there's a certain irony to the title with easy to understand. I mean, I don't know if Peter meant it that way, but to me, because oftentimes his poetry is not easy for me to understand. I mean, I enjoy reading it because he's really always got these edgy, hard-hitting lines. He's got social commentary to me, and just this kind of biting, gritty sense of humor. Whenever I read something that mentions a pig farm, you know, I always think of the story Animal Farm, and I forget which person wrote that. I think, was it George Orwell, or was it the other one?
Yes, Orwell.
Yes. That kind of gave me a whole Animal Farm Orwellian feel to it. But yeah, this has amazing imagery and metaphors. And oftentimes I really just go with the first thing that comes out of my head or my fingers when I'm reading Pierre Solway. And I thought it was a thought-provoking write with fighting lines on people who don't understand what or why they're judging in a stretching out of a history of perversion. And it really does take a deep look at our own, I think, inner securities when it comes to sex and our perversion and how we, you know, people will judge other people but not look at themselves. I also really like, I really like this all the way through, but especially test pendings, more scams, imminent, undressed for the polite nurse, wig and all, sad facts of the fate of this case, can't judge a book by its cover or date, lured with pictures of a bold murder, mother stabbed in underwear. I mean, just really visceral imagery that speaks, you know, just on the horrific idea of what lays underneath. Like you see about somebody all dressed prim and proper, and you think there's nothing under, everything underneath is prim and proper, but it's like the whitewashed walls that Jesus referred to the Pharisees, or, you know, the hypocrites that presents that, that perfect presentation of that whitewashed walls. But underneath there's all that corruption. So just a wonderful, thought-provoking write, and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah, I too really like this piece. So the interesting thing is that really made me rethink the quote, because the quote, why should things be easy to understand, I always took as Pynchon responding to his critics, who were like, you are incomprehensible, and him saying, well, why should things be easy to understand? And I liked that that Peter makes us think beyond that obvious interpretation of the Pynchon quote, and instead to look at, is life itself, is society easy to understand? And it's a nice way of looking at that quote, because it makes us turn around and rethink the Pynchon quote and see, is Pynchon himself saying, why should life be easy to understand? I thought it a somewhat surreal, Pollock-like, Kafka-esque offering on life and all that is hard to understand, both morally and metaphysically. Very nicely done, as Peter, you know, always gives us meaty poetry to chew on for this show, and I certainly appreciate his efforts. Okay, Pam, back to you.
All right. Up next we have When I See on TV by Ken Smith. And Laurent, will you please give that a read for us?
By all means. A crowd of people walking a busy street of a metropolis, downturned heads bobbing, strangers passing shoulder to shoulder, the muted disconnect. It wasn't like that today at the rally. We were one voice. We were all poets speaking on the crumbled state of Ontario healthcare right in our backyard. While the daily papers print the news in white letters to hide the truth in blank, empty words.
Great read, Laurent. So that was a response to prompt two, which is, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers. And this is one that is another kind of speaking of truth to power. And it also kind of takes away that myth of the grass being greener on the other side of the septic tank, because healthcare is something that no one seems to be able to get right. And I just imagine, living in the U.S., that socialized medicine must be superior to the nightmare that we struggle with here in the United States. But Ken dissuades me of that delusion and shows that Canada, for example, has a flawed system too, especially like that for that final stanza where the daily papers print the news in white letters to hide the truth in blank, empty words. How beautifully written that is. It transcends the specifics, healthcare, and shows the larger flaws within our social fabric. Nicely done. And Pam, your thoughts.
Yeah, as always, Ken Smith has offered up a wonderful brevity with that straightforward language that is so accessible and yet at the same time has such a layered feel to it. I always enjoy and appreciate his style. I thought there was hard-hitting imagery in this, and it was an excellent write on people who speak in one voice against injustice and how oftentimes when it comes to protesting against something or, you know, speaking up against something, it doesn't help necessarily to have one person at a time, but rather you need that united front, all speaking together. I really liked the ending in this and how he speaks on the idea of how media nowadays is just oftentimes a falseness to it that you know hides the truth that needs to be seeked. So wonderful lines and very well done.
Excellent comment there, Pam. And Laurence, I'll give you final word on this.
Yeah, Pam spoke recently, just a little bit ago, about whitewashing. And that last stanza brings that out for me. While the daily papers print the news in white letters to hide the truth in blank, empty words, it's part of the they who can get you asking the wrong questions. Because if they misdirect you, if they mislead you, in the beginning, you never ask the right questions, and you'll never get to the truth, which is exactly what they wish to hide. It's a dissembling. It's it's artful lying through omission, which we see so often in today's news. The one voice that poets are speaking with is the exact opposite of the muted disconnect of strangers passing shoulder to shoulder, which is addressed in the first stanza. And, you know, as long as that happens, we can't accomplish much. But when you do gather together to speak with one voice, it's incredible what you can accomplish. And then you'll ask the right questions.
Nicely stated there, Laurent. Great comment. Okay, Pam. I see you put the next one up.
Yes, this is Death Cries Echoing the Skies by Jenny the Deep. A screaming comes across the sky. The stinging revolver slips from his hand. Lovers to foes, their love dies as he catches her with another in the sand. Drowning from lies, no truth to stay afloat. His love was real, but she treated it as a joke. Skies turned sullen gray as they kissed in the light of day. Conundrum continues, containing cries. Chances given to her was met with resentment. Kept digging herself deeper in lies. Ending it, he releases the trigger of regret. End poem.
Nice read, Pam. I love where Jenny went with this, because a screaming comes across the sky always makes me think of the V2 rockets, and she took us in an entirely unique, different direction, and that's the beauty of these shows, is how it sparks the creativity of the poet to take the quote, make it their own, bring it into their own thought stream, and personalize it. And I thought Jenny offered a strong storytelling poem of infidelity, violence, and the inevitable regret. Nicely done throughout. Very nice. And Laurent, your thoughts?
The act of discovering the person you love in the arms of another one creates a strange sound in the mind, and it's not even a sound. It's almost something inexplicable, and it could be described as a screaming, and when it comes across the sky, it's all-encompassing. It affects everything. Drowning from lies, no truth to stay afloat. You literally are drowning in an emotional morass. And, you know, when he says the stinging revolver slips from his hand, or what she says, the stinging revolver slips from his hand, it's the ultimate regret for having loved someone who was untrue and who has wounded you to the point where you're willing to take a life. Now, whether it's literal or metaphorical, I'm not entirely sure, but he releases the trigger of regret. It's so well framed, and it implies so much. Jay did a great job of this piece.
Absolutely. Great analysis. And Pam, I will give you last word.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Sorry, I don't know why I said that. Just one thing that slipped out. But I thought this was an amazing write. You know, a great story write. I like that she, and I think A Screaming Comes Across the Sky is a quote that definitely calls for a dark right. But I like that, as you said, that she took it in her own direction, you know, and like focuses in on the idea of maybe the sound you would imagine a bullet would make. I like that she tells us the story and introduces us to these who are both volatile in nature with only three short stanzas. I particularly like his love was real, but she treated it as a joke. You see instantly there that there's this imbalance in a relationship, and there's nothing that hurts more than, you know, offering up your love that is real and having somebody treat it either as a joke or be indifferent to it, you know. And then also I really like those end lines. Kept digging herself deeper in lies, ending it, he releases the trigger of regret. And you can just imagine, and that was a great end line to end on, because that trigger of regret, I think, speaks on the thought that the moment he pulled that trigger and that bullet was released, he knew he couldn't take it back. And while one part of his problems was over, in that moment that he pulled that trigger and released that bullet, new problems would arise. So wonderful, right, and very well done.
Excellent comment there, Pam. Okay, where would you like to go next?
All right, well, up next, Richard, I'm going to put your poem. So go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
Okay, and this was inspired by the beginning of Gravity's Rainbow. And it is called A Screaming Comes Across the Sky. Our Clear Blue Horizon, Black Tarred by One Madman's Nightmare. As I hold stale air, moments by frozen moments, bracing for impact. Exhale, blinking light, still here. My naked ears still shredded by their incendiary screams. Winter's impossible white blanket momentarily quells dark voices. July's corn crop laid waste by the whim of brass-chested old men. The incessant wail of terrible infants, their diapers dirty, their hunger insatiable as they claw at cold blue maternal breast. A blindfolded prophet again motions to our scorched horizon, whispering, all this has happened before, but now there is nothing to compare it to. End of poem. And Pam, I'll let you try.
Yes. Wonderful, wonderful read and write there, Richard. And Laurent, your thoughts? Are you on mute, Laurent?
Yes, I was testing the mute button, and I'm pleased to tell you that it's still working fine. You know, you got to test these things. I thought you took a Screaming Comes Across the Sky and did a wonderful job of expressing the way that might happen if indeed a clear blue horizon was black tarred by one madman's nightmare. And war of any kind is a nightmare, but there's that one war, that atomic war that has always, ever since the 50s, lurked just out of sight on the horizon. It's always there as a possibility, but something that we absolutely, you know, we all think it's impossible, but it's not impossible. And if and when there is such a thing, on hopes there isn't, you get that nuclear winter. And, that, you know, you say winter's impossible white blanket, followed by July's corn crop laid waste. In order for those things to happen, there's got to be something pretty special. And the incendiary screams that you mentioned also lead me to believe that, you know, this was something of that nature, that blinking light. You ever seen an atomic explosion? It not only sheds, spreads everything around it, but it produces an incredible white light. Well, white. Orange, just an incredible light. And I'm wondering if you don't reference that there. And that light doesn't go away very quickly because that cloud, that nuclear cloud, just grows and grows and rises thousands of feet up into the air. And what follows all of that is the incessant wail of terrible infants, their diapers dirty, their hunger insatiable, because there is no more food. Indeed, nothing can compare it with it because it hasn't happened yet. Let us hope it doesn't. This is quite brilliant, my friend. And I knew I was going to be in trouble, but I completely forgot to go ahead and comment on this initially. I would have offered something a good deal more polished. This poem certainly deserves it.
Thank you, Laurent.
Wonderful comment there, Laurent. Yeah, this is just brilliant. It's amazing imagery and metaphors throughout. It speaks on such an ugly truth, and the idea of, you know, as Laurent was saying, if that atomic bomb was released and the world was destroyed, this really speaks on that impact, that change that would come about. And how, even if, you know, if there were survivors, you know, they would have nothing to compare it to. And I like how this goes into the big picture by looking at part of everyday life, like where it says winter's impossible white blanket momentarily quells dark voices, July's corn crop laid waste by the whim of brass-chested old men. July's corn crop laid waste really appealed to me because, you know, our farmers are and the American farms that provide food are such an important resource. And to have those laid waste by people who don't see the big picture, but rather think only of their own egos, I think is just such a horrific possibility to think about. And, of course, the incessant wail of terrible infants, their diapers dirty, they're hungry and insatiable, as they claw at cold, blue maternal breasts. That whole stand in itself makes a wonderful metaphor, not only for does it represent the infants that will die, but it has a layeredness to it, representing the cry of the greedy. Excellent write and very well done.
Thanks so much, Pam. Okay, and where would you like to go next?
All right. Well, up next, I am going to put Lauren's poem. So when you see it, Lauren, go ahead and read it for us, please.
I will. Thank you. Ghosts Without Gods. 3:30 a.m. A call to be awake. Regardless of ambient temperature. Quiet world, buried in dark cloth. All sounds muffled, all eyes shuttered. Light is localized, artificial, a continuous pulse that elevates insomnia into the almost inevitable act of nocturnal creation. Dark light, as differentiated from daylight, is the yellow-white blood of intelligence in a maze, seeking escape, bursting beyond left and right turns onto a straightaway that screams towards the stars. Quiet grimace on the face of Monkey Man as he strides forward is the only concession to his struggle to push back darkness. Morbid twists of the face that holds all wars, all sacrifice, all injustice within the creases around careworn eyes. We have become ghosts without gods, leapfrogging from club and cave to an immortal sentience that bleeds beneath the stark ages of driven man, whose circumpolar languages of skywriting, vivid hieroglyphics, carved in pyramidal homage, hang visible, end of the darkest nights of an absent moon, graven by a scrivener in rags, bone quills scratching truths that bite stone monoliths with sharp teeth. 3:55 ends an interval that marks creation of the moment as eyes wide open descend to eyes wide shut, opening a luminous universe of dreams. Deep well where imagination travels the yellow brick road towards understanding the purgatory of our faith, where dark light was born, a candle we snuff out with a switch. End poem.
Wow. Of all, such a dense and layered poem. So I know we don't normally do this, but I would welcome any comments that you, Laurent, have about this piece, just because it is such kind of a panoramic display.
Yeah, it's well, it literally was 3:30, and I could not sleep and decided to try and express what I was feeling at the time. And I remember looking at the temperature, thing of the temperature in the room was 72, 73 degrees, and yet I felt chilled, cold for some reason. And I began thinking about how quiet the world was and ways of expressing that. Then I started thinking about where would we be, where would I be in that moment if there was no light? If all there was still flickering firelight somewhere, and that's all that we had. And I saw that light could be described as a continuous pulse, because it is in many ways. And then I thought about, well, we have daylight. There's no such thing as a night light. If there are lights at night, it could be considered dark light. And dark light, you know, is the conquering, really, of the world in many ways. Because when we were able to come up with artificial light, it really changed the entire world in a way that I don't think we can appreciate today. And to me, it represented, well, as I said, the blood of intelligence and amaze seeking escape from the constraints of nature, one of which is darkness. And then I thought about all the struggles that we have had in trying to move forward in the regard to conquering the darkness, but also all the technology that we come up with and how difficult it has been to get there, and all the things that happened to create those, including wars, all sacrifices, all the injustices that we meet within life. And by accepting that level of technology and the rational mind of science, in a way, God slips away from us as we begin to think about the fact that, you know, there is no heaven, there is no hell, there was no creation of the world in 7 days, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know where all of that is going. And then our ability to communicate worldwide instantly, which I called the circumpolar language of skywriting. And you could almost make those or imagine them as vivid hieroglyphics. That's kind of all the things that was going through my mind as I was writing this particular piece. And I mentioned the understanding the purgatory of our faith. You know, when we accept something as true as part of our life, faith, and belief, it can be a purgatory if we cling to it so strongly that it denies other things or makes us feel so desperate at the thought of it not being true. And then, of course, the end, you always look for a little hook on the end. And I thought about the candles that we used to use for electricity. And they represent, you know, the dark light of that day, which we now can snuff out or turn off with a switch.
Yeah.
And that is that.
Yeah. That is an amazing poem. And thank you for that. I did catch most of the beats, but it's always nice to hear the poet give an analysis. And I thought this was just amazing poetry. Modern man's paradoxical place, freed from darkness by technology, which paradoxically darkens with its screaming that comes across the sky. There were so many powerful stanzas, but I especially like that quiet grimace on the face of Monkey Man as he strides forward is the only concession to his struggle to push back darkness. It's just a brilliant poem, and it definitely it was one of the ones that I highlighted as one of my favorites on this website. So thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And Pam, your thoughts?
Oh, this is definitely a powerful write with strong imagery and metaphors. And I enjoyed listening to Laurent talk about his poem and you know, what he was expressing with it. And I like that thought because I think it is an important thought, the idea of, you know, how far is too far when it comes to technology, you know, because it is both a blessing and a curse. I too was really drawn to that quiet grimace on the face stanza, but I also really like, we have become ghosts without gods, leapfrogging from club and cave to an immortal sentience. that bleed beneath the stark ages of driven man, and whose circumpolar languages of skywriting, vivid hieroglyphics carved in paramental homage, hang visible, penned on the darkest night of an absent moon. I think that to me speaks almost the idea of as if we're building our own Tower of Babel, and it's all about to just come crashing around us. So just an amazing write, Laurent, and very well done.
Thank you, Pam.
Great comment, Pam. Okay, where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, we have The Irish Goodbye by Ben Hart, and we have a SoundCloud for that one.
Yep. Let me fire her up.
The Irish Goodbye, a poem by Ben Hart. 1. The Leaving. She's running from peripheral human consciousness back into the exile of memory, returning to her name at the altar of the bottomless fall where identity is anonymous and she gave up all for a shot at a brighter infinity. And she left us something upon leaving. 2. The Soft. To her opposite, in their imperfect romance, she left her ability to love without blame. All she had meant to give him in hopes he could at least forgive her for her surrender unto nothingness. And he spent it well on someone equally untamed. 3. The Sharp. And to the Joker, who failed her, who didn't understand it was not about making you laugh or smile for a moment, it was about making you stay, she left him with the weight of his failure, a millstone on his chest to kill the laughter upon every visit to the mirror. 4. The Storm. And she left me her grief, her misery, her need to be alone, her pain, her dissuasion, her disarray. She only got out of this by trading places. And she gave Belial my name. Love without blame, a heart of bone won't beat again. Well, guess what, bitch? At least I could weather it. I fought the noose and I didn't lose a drop of blood, and it only took 8 years to forget your touch, but it only took one decision to give up and throw someone you said you loved into discourse, into exile, into rot. To numb and ease away the years, and only weep for absent tears, you took everything. But look at what I built, from the nothing you left me with in the wake of your leaving. I have become a healer, a plagiarist tragedy, wielder of meaning, maker of majesty, keeper of cathedrals, fixer of the feeble, immortalizer of the fleeting, god of war, and preacher of peace. And I didn't need you for any of it, because you never believed in me. I don't know who I was to you, besides what your mother said I must have meant. Darling, I don't understand why I too had to die, or what I must have done to deserve the liar's favorite, Irish goodbye. Stay a while and watch, oblivion coming ashore somewhere in the back of her eyes, her name in the sand, erased over and over again. I thought we were friends. End poem.
Thank you, Ben, for the SoundCloud. That was actually the first time I've heard Ben do a recitation of his work, and wow, amazing. Powerful poetry. I like the transition from third person in the first three sections to first person in the final section as a method of building vulnerability, emotional immediacy, and identification with the narrator's pain. Really well done piece. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Of course you come to me first. I'm all too willing to hand it off to Pam, who deserves this one. No, sorry. His delivery, his spoken delivery, was, I don't believe his normal reading voice. It was a fascinating voice that he chose to read the poem with. Very eclectic, very brimful of energy, very not desperate, but very forceful in its ability to speed through a rather long poem and then slow it down at exactly the right places. The the breakdown, the leaving, the soft, the sharp, the storm is very fascinating in his selections of description. When love leaves you, He's running from peripheral human consciousness back into the exile of memory. Phrasing that allows us to understand that memories are our own and no one else's, and it's an exile of a type. And the soft, who could also be called the wounded, to her opposite in their imperfect romance, what a clever way of referring to himself in that particular case. A woman who not blame anyone else for her ability to love without blame. You know, she's not going to stay faithful to him, perhaps. When he said, and he spent it well on someone equally untamed, the hope, I wonder whether he was referring to perhaps a tryst as a result of her leaving him. And then the sharp to the joker who failed her. I wonder, is he referring to himself at this point? Again, I'm not entirely sure. The storm is the emotional storm, of course, that we all suffer, the misery, the pain, as a result of the dissuasion and the disarray that she had. It's the kind of poem you want to be able to read 2-4 times, think about, and then perhaps come up with something intelligent to say. It, like many great poems, it is also layered and really a delight to listen to and to read with a very poignant end. Her name in the sand erased over and over again. Thought we were friends. She's an amazing poet.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah. Ben definitely offers up plenty of food for thought when it comes to, when writing poems. And it's so great to hear him record his poem because he adds just the right voice to his lines. It's a wonderful vignette, strong imagery and metaphors. The title, The Irish Goodbye, made me think of the, was it Frank McCourt who wrote Angela's Ashes, which was like his autobiography? I think so, mm-hmm. Yeah. It made me think of how oftentimes there's this idea and that comes, and oftentimes not just a preconceived idea, but it comes through in many writings of Irish authors, the idea of depression and despair. And you definitely get a sense of loss in this one. And, whether it was, I think perhaps it was a loss from death. But what I like about this one is, first of all, like you said, Richard, that transition from third person to first person, which suddenly makes it even more tragic because it becomes even more personal. But the idea that this reminds us that anger is very much a part of grief, that we can be angry at the person who walked away, that we can be angry at the person who chose to take their own life. I really like the lines, to numb and ease away the years and only weep for absent tears. You took everything, but look what I built from the nothing you left me in the wake of your leaving. Wonderful lines and very well done.
Absolutely great comment. And with that, we are ready for our next one.
All right. Let's see here. All right. Grabbing the next one. And doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. All right, and here we go. Up next we have And Then It Dawned Into Prelude by Haps and it goes like this. Sorry, my screen's being a little slow. There we go. You saw me naked to fall head down like a ripe apple from the branch. Gray moon tiredly sat down on the water and kissed the surface. Mwah. Water, warm water carried me with ripples. I tensed my muscles and spread my bent legs as if making love. You gazed and gasped with stretched palms on my hard nipples, teeth nibble nipple, chest rippled like rye, my waist bent like a willow rod, and you dried my wet mouth with hot kisses. Fawn whistled in the cherry branches and cursed our minds. An owl echoed with who song and poem.
Nice read there, Pam. Very nice. I thought this was a wonderful piece. So riffing off of the prompt, which was, you go from dream to dream inside me. You have passage to my last shabby corner, and there, among the debris, you found life. I'm no longer sure which of all the words, images, dreams, or ghosts are yours and which are mine. It's past sorting out. And Hatz provides us with a word painting which is quite sensual. It has great metaphors and similes and anthropomorphism throughout. I thought it was an excellent riffing off of the Pynchon prompt. Very well done. And Ron, your thoughts?
Yeah, that one you took for yourself first, huh, you devil? You. The sensuality in this was almost unexpected because we don't get many sensual poems on your show, Richard. I'm not sure whether the last stanza is the most important one. Fawn whistled in the cherry branches and cursed our minds. An owl echoed with whose song. Was when he says cursed our minds, a distraction perhaps, something other than the moment that was occurring, a moment of conjugation when two become one to the extent that nothing else exists in that moment unless that moment is broken by, for instance, Fawn whistled in the cherry branches and an owl agreed. Sensuality is, I want to say, clean. There's nothing of it that is not pure. If you want to look at the act of love as the pure joining of two souls, of two spirits, it's pretty amazing. I enjoyed it a great deal.
Excellent comment. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I really like this. First of all, I like how she used the sound words, like the sound of a kiss and the sound of that an owl makes within this. And some nice use of alliteration. It's a beautiful rite with sensuality on love and connection and an offering up of oneself. And I like how it speaks on the idea that love and sex nourishes the same way that nature nourishes. So wonderful lines and very well done.
Excellent comment there, Pam. Great. Okay, so where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, we have To the Soundtrack of Silver Gulls by Poems of Rain. And go ahead, Richard, and give that a read for us, please.
Okay, so this is Poems of Rain. It's called To the Soundtrack of Silver Gulls. post-storm, pre-apocalypse, knees scraped and scarlet. We collapse in the afterwards, finding home mid the dirt, the debris, and the carnage. The stars, miming scars, barely the moon to console us. Sidelined by syncope, took a slug of the stuff that we brewed in those dandelions. Loyal to the craft, you wore your poet hat with the muck and the mire still piping with poetry. It rained come the morning, light, forgiving. We woke to the soundtrack, silver gulls screaming on skylines, confirming that yes, it survived. End of poem. And Pam, your thoughts on this piece?
First of all, I don't think I've read this poet before. If I have, it's been a while. She's got this is a really thoughtful and beautiful poem. Amazing imagery and metaphors. I like how it speaks as a story, right? But it also speaks as a metaphor. And I really like how she speaks on the power of the poet and the power of the pen. But how in the end, you know, like where it says, loyal to the craft, you wore your poet hat through the muck and the mire, still piping with poetry. That makes me think of many of the famous war poets of the World War II era. And the idea that the art form of poetry and art in general and the creative heart and mind will survive. So wonderful write and very well done.
Great comment there, Pam. And Laurent, your thoughts.
Yeah, if I can get off mute. Yeah, I was briefly, yes. This immediately struck me as a home that had been completely erased by a tornado. I've been watching a fair number of tornado videos this year, because there have been some doozies, and those are beasts. And the destruction they leave behind is an absolutely apocalyptical. And yes, put home in quotes, because there is no home left. It's almost just bare ground and rubble. And the stars miming scars, and barely the moon to console us, is such a sad image, if you think about it. The loyal to the craft, you wore your poet hat through the muck and the mire, still piping with poetry. Once a poet, always a poet. And you may be sitting there in the ruins of your home, because I'm quite willing to take this entire piece at a literal level. You're still yourself. You're still the poet. So even though you're full of muck and mire, you're still coming out with the kind of lines that a poet might come out with in extraordinary moments, because you're going to be yourself. You're not going to change. And that we woke with the soundtrack of Silver Gulls screaming on the skyline, confirming that, yes, we survive. It's to me, that speaks of hope. It screams of the ocean. It screams of possibilities. It's something that you would hear if you were alive, obviously deceased. Now, this thing may be an entire metaphor for something that I don't know, it struck me as being very, very real.
Great comment. Yeah, so I too really love this piece. I thought it very layered. It's full of vivid imagery and yet simultaneously full of good ambiguity, because I too thought that it could be a literal recording of a natural disaster by the poet, or it could be taken metaphorically. And I loved how it kind of works simultaneously on both levels. You know, that it could all just be, a mental struggle with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that life is full of. And it works either way. So very intelligent poem, very well done. And Pam, I am bringing it back to you.
All right. Well, up next we have Wrong, Just Wrong by Sam Sampson. And Laurent, would you give that a read for us, please?
Interesting. Wrong, just wrong. Each day another scandal breaks. Both sides talk but say no words. Turn out others to do their dirty work, refusing to answer their crimes and misdemeanors. Questions asked, quickly deflected. Questions raised, willful lies in return. They wait patiently till they're asked the wrong questions so they can give the wrong answers, hoping that like sheep, you will be led to the slaughter. End quote.
Nicely read there, Laurent. Yeah, a very powerful brevity, strong poetic speaking of truth to the corrupt political powers, nicely argued throughout. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a wonderful write by Sam. I like the flow of this. I like how it speaks on the sleight of hand and the smoke and mirror games played by those who refuse to face their own guilt and try to misguide people. I really like this all the way through, but especially questions asked, quickly deflected, questions raised, skillful lies in return. They wait patiently instead. They are asked the wrong questions so they can give the wrong answers, hoping that like sheep, you will be led to the slaughter. You know, and you can see that what they want to be the end results of the game played is to have no one that would question their crimes and their misdemeanors. So wonderful write and very well done.
Absolutely. And Laurent, your thoughts?
When they talk about the fog of war, there's an equivalency. It's the fog of politics, the fog of deliberate lies by omission. This is such a wonderful description of something I've seen played out on television over and over again. When someone is being interviewed, normally a senator, representative, or whoever, and they will sit and they will just, with a blank face, just look at you and utter the stupidest things you've ever heard in your life. And if you allow yourself if you allow your questions to be deflected, and if you allow lies to creep in without being fact-checked during the moment, at that moment, you're going to get yourself, get led down the primrose path by the nose, and they're gonna take hours to expound on their lies if you give them that opportunity. And by doing so, you know, you're just going to be led to the slaughter. Because when they lie in front of you, the American and population and the world in general, and nobody immediately stops them in their tracks, it's almost like suicide. It's a great little goose.
Absolutely. Great comment. And with that, Pam, I am turning it back to you.
All right. Well, up next we have Only Words on a Page, a collaboration between Heavenly Angel and Easy Writer. And it goes like this. I know these are only words on a page, but I adore the special way you love me. Since we met, the whole world is our stage. It's exactly what I dreamed, true love would be. Everything you do is aimed to please. My heart you stole and tenderly whisked it away. With your whispers of love, soft as a murmuring breeze. the romance of ours is surely here to stay. Yes, my angel, a love like ours will never die. It will grow and grow like the vines on the rose to a cling. You'll always be to me the apple of my eye and everything I ever hoped true love could bring. And no, babe, these were not just mere words you sent. You'll never really know how much to me they meant. End poem.
Great read, Pam. What a sweet and powerful love poem by our pair of lovers, Evie Ryder and Heavenly Angel. Great collaboration. And I love that you really can't determine, like, who is writing which stanza. It just flows as if it's one poet writing, and that too is quite a gift. I thought it was heartfelt love poetry throughout. The rhyming scheme brought it to life, and quite a powerful ad for our celebration of pension. And Laurent, your thoughts? Are you on mute? Oh, I'm sorry. He dropped. Well, I want to thank him for sharing the evening of Pynchon with us and Pam. And that means that we are dialoguing. So I am turning it to you, your thoughts.
All right. Well, I thought this was absolutely beautiful. What a wonderful collaboration that flowed without force. Such heartfelt lines speaking on love and connection and a true and honest love, you know, where you trust and feel everything the person says. I really like this all the way through and, you know, especially I like the first stanza and then where it says, with your whispers of love, soft as a murmuring breeze, this romance of ours is surely here to stay. I like that it speaks on understanding how deep and lasting a love is. So very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment there, Pam. Okay. Where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next we have Night Waters, or what is that called? Night Poets by Sarah Walters. And go ahead, Richard, and give that a read for us, please.
Absolutely. Yes, this is Night Poets by Sarah Walters, and it goes like this. In the still of the night, when all the world is asleep, poets come alive. Create, to dream, to leap. Inspired by Pynchon's words, they roam the land of the mind, where reality and fiction merge, where the impossible is defined. They weave a tapestry of verse with words as their thread and loom, pulling from the depth within to create a masterpiece in bloom. The rhythm of their words, a symphony of sound and tone, echoing through the silent night as they pour their hearts into the unknown. Paint a canvas with their words, with colors bright and bold, capturing the essence of life and their stories left untold. For late night poets, the night is their muse, and they are its willing slaves, captivated by the magic of words, with no thought of the time they gave. So let us celebrate the poets, keep the night alive, with their words of love and loss, and their stories that never die. For in the still of the night, when all the world is asleep, poets come alive. And their words are ours to keep. The poem. Well, Pam, I will give you first word.
All right. Well, first of all, a wonderful read there. I thought this was a beautiful tribute to the power of words, the power of the poet, and how oftentimes the poet's heart and the poet's mind connects with nighttime. There's almost this release of creativity for many people within those midnight hours, within those dark hours, and how the you know, once those words are put down, they become a part of human history. So wonderful lines and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment there, Pam. And a nice tribute to late night poets woven into the piece. I really like this piece. I thought it was tightly crafted rhyming poetry. Reading it aloud on the air was a joy. The words kind of just melt in your mouth and resound in the air. It celebrates the creativity of poets as well as the hours of their inspiration, what I like to call the clock's weakest hours, and thought it truly an enjoyable piece throughout. Very well done. Okay, Pam, I see you have the next one up.
Yep. Up next, we have Corners by Weaver of Dreams, and it goes like this. I gave you permission to rummage around in my brain, sweep aside the cobwebs to then reveal all my pain. In the corners, you'll find my might-have-been moments covered in dust, our forays labeled never, ever again. At night, I hear ghosts and wraiths moan and mumble. Your parents are mine, unhappy with our life choices so far. Past lovers and enemies alike complaining we are cold. Mine especially are vocal and strident in their united condemnation of my inability to empathize or bother to pretend I care. It seems we belong together, neither one capable of love. However, we do share a warped outlook on what we need, which is nothing, no one, solitude, silence, and above all, freedom and poem.
Nicely read there, Pam. Yeah, I love this piece. It is a great take on Prompt 10, and Prompt 10 brought our lovers out, and it brought us a lot of straight ahead love poetry, but I felt like Weaver of Dreams had a unique and different take on Prompt 10. It is a love poem, but Weaver captures the paradox of love, how we nurture and support each other's journeys to self-actualization and freedom, and therefore how true love opens us to true selfhood and freedom. So I thought it was very intelligent, thoroughly enjoyable, and highly identifiable as someone who is in a committed relationship with a partner, and both of us are working towards self-actualization. So it hit all the right notes for me. Very nicely done. And Pam, what did you think of the piece?
Oh, I really liked this. It kind of gave me a Romeo and Juliet in modern times vibe, but instead of focus on political family dynamics, it focused more on emotional family dynamics and the idea of a modern day relationship of two people who are very antisocial, very independent, and don't need to be in a relationship, but choose to be despite the disapproval of others. And I thought this had strong lines all the way through, but especially are vocal and strident in their united condemnation of my inability to empathize or bother to pretend I care. You know, some people just can't handle people who are straightforward, you know, and speak their mind. I just thought this was a wonderful write all the way through and very well done. And I like that she ended with that one word, freedom. So very cool and very well done.
Absolutely. Yeah. Excellent piece. Great comment. Okay, so how are we doing? It looks like we have one more.
Well, you were actually all done with your writes, your poems, so I figured I'd put one up that I felt kind of worked. You know, I didn't have time to really think too much about it. So, but this is my poem, An Oasis in a Desert of Dying Starfish, and it was written to this, it was a contest that Eric, geez, why am I blanking out? Well, you know, good old Eric. Eric Svensson had put up that his friend Oral Erickson had his painting was his, and so I wrote to this, and it goes like this: Warrior of harmony, following the ways of ancient times. He wears a crown of baobab wood, knowing we are all roots on the tree of life. His dark eyes intently watch, seeking the good and beautiful spirits in a time of garbage can fires and indifference to life falling to the curbside. People are suffering the humility of a last breath drawn. Oh, how his heart weeps. Tears of angels with broken wings, and his soul is the constant prayer of the sorrowful man. Palms covered with calluses hold the staff made of willow wood. He knows he is called to help and heal, but alas, he cannot do it alone. He feels his spine bending beneath the weight of greed in a hurry-scurry world of violence and dying starfish. He knows he is called to be a shepherd, but the great shepherd that lives in the sky, that lives in all things. He looks for others who will nourish the hungry, comfort the dying, and lead the flock to the oasis in the desert. Spiritual blessings and wishes the same for all mankind. His heart finds rejoicing as he dances upon the wind and awakens to the cherry juice sun rising. End poem.
Wow, Pam, what an amazing piece. So, first things first, a great recitation really brought it to life. And secondly, I'm going to apologize because normally I read these things before, but I will say what a beautiful riffing off of the image, and it's a powerful painting. It has that kind of primitive vibe to it, and simultaneously very powerful spiritual image. That, and you, your poem truly did this justice. It is very religious. It has the iconography of the Judeo-Christian motif, and simultaneously it transcends a lot of the tribalism that sometimes that motif can get bogged down in. Instead, it really does speak to the best of the tradition, to the patience and the love of divinity encased in human form. And it's just a very, very powerful and hopeful spiritual piece, showing us.
Thank you very much.
God.
And yeah, I did.
Go ahead. Thank you.
I appreciate the thoughtful comment. I was going to say, I saw the same thing in the painting, the idea of the spirituality and the sense of almost a calmness within the eyes of the painting, and also how it had that kind of, almost antique type look to it. So very cool. Thank you.
Yeah, it all really came across in your poem. So I thought it was a perfect way for us to end our evening of celebration of Thomas Pynchon, who, although he is a very postmodern and political writer, he is actually, I would argue, also a spiritual writer. So it was nice that your poem kind of brought that part of his message front and center and spotlighted it. A hopeful way to end the evening celebration of Pynchon. Okay.
Wonderful. And great show tonight.
Yeah. And I know we have a little time left, probably just enough for us to get a teaser from you of what's coming up in a half hour.
Ooh, in a half hour we have Break On Through, which I am calling a mix and match show because I have four writes from four different contests. I have a Piet Mondrian quote, a Piet Mondrian artwork. I have a contest that I titled Clichés, which I had a bunch of different quotes about clichés, whether they're a positive or a negative thing. And then I had one other contest, which has the quote, "The great god Pan is dead" by Plutarch. So it's definitely going to be an interesting mix and match, hodgepodge of poetry tonight.
Great. I love the cliche thing. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the show, the TV show, The Sopranos, David Chase, the creator, creates this character called, Little Carmine. And Little Carmine tries to show his intelligence by saying cliches. And it is hysterically funny. Yeah, it's just, yeah, if you look up on YouTube, Little Carmine Sopranos or something like that, or probably Little Carmine is enough.
Check that out.
It's hysterical. It's some of the funniest stuff I've ever heard. He's just a great, you know, and he's not thought of as a comedy writer, but there is a lot of comedy in the Sopranos, and especially it is chock full in Little Carmine. So it's when you say cliches and the good and bad of it, that's what made me think of, because
cool.
David Chase, yeah, he has so much fun with the topic. So it's really funny. And yeah, what a great show we put together. So thank you so much for jumping in and sub co-hosting for my sub co-host.
Well, I hope she's feeling all right. And
me too.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And just so we're all on the same page, Neutron, I've been speaking to her. She's coming back. We just got to be patient. She's coming back. So, and we do miss
her. Oh, wonderful.
Thanks so much. Yes, thanks so much for your help, Pam. Thanks to Laurent, and we are off the air.